American Cassette Ministries is pleased to provide you with another presentation from the 2005 General Youth Conference in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Thousands of committed Seventh-day Adventist young people came together as an army on a mission to proclaim the three angels' messages to the whole world in this generation. They believe now is the time.
I appreciate you guys coming out. I've come a long way to come and talk with you. And we'll see how well this session goes. We're dealing with a very complicated issue. Before I begin, I have a limited number of our publication, Front Lines of Freedom. Why would you want to have a copy of our publication? Friends, because it is beautifully written. It is inspiring. Look at those color pictures. But maybe even more than that, on the inside is a feature on where our interns are now. Now, I mentioned in our last session that we have a fairly robust contingent from the Korean Adventist community, some of whom were sleepy last session, I might say. Shocking but true, I'm not pointing out. In here is a feature on Miriam Cho, who was one of our interns, one of the brightest and best that our church has, along with folks from a variety of other backgrounds. I only have a limited number. Maybe who's going to volunteer to hand these out, just to people who put up their hands who will be interested? Will you just hand those out? And if you're interested, put up your hand. I only want people who are literate, because this isn't going to do a whole lot of good for if you're not. I also want to give you a website just to start off. I hope you've all got pens. If you don't have a pen, I hope you've got a decent memory. The website I want to give you, and I want you all to go to, and I want you to sign up for our free email updates. It doesn't come cheaper than that, friends. The updates are, let me repeat, F-R-E-E, free. And they give you the update on what's happening for our work on Capitol Hill. That website is www.religiousliberty. How many of you can remember that? Religiousliberty.info. I-N-F-O. I can see some of you are knitting instead of writing. Friends, get out those pens. Unless you're already signed up for these free updates, you'll want to get on board. About 16,200 people have signed up for these updates so far. We estimate about 40,000 people get each update, because many of them are sent to church groups. You are missing out if you are not getting these updates. Once again, free updates on our religious liberty work on Capitol Hill, www.religiousliberty.info. Let's start with one of my favorite texts. It's found in the book of Revelation. Revelation 22, verse 14 and 15. I'm going to read 15 first and then 14. You want to end on the good news, not the bad news. The bad news is that outside are the dogs and sorcerers, the sexually immoral, murderers and idolaters, whoever loves and practices a lie. Friends, we are living in a society where sexual immorality is absolutely the norm. You know it. You're out there in schools, you're out there in society. It's not easy to be someone who follows God. It's not. It wasn't when I was in school, and it's not now when you are. And if you think that you're just going to float along and be different, you're wrong. Unless you're connected to God in a very real way, you are going to be like your peers. And friends, your peers are going to be outside the kingdom, many of them. Sexual immorality, idolatry, you can also talk about materialism there, which is a form of idolatry. Outside. But inside, we're told, blessed are those who do his commandments. that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the gates into the city. Friends, I don't know many of you. This is the first time we've been together, but it's my prayer, my sincere prayer, that each one of us will be found inside the city. But friends, I want to make no bones about it. There's no ambiguity here. If you're part of the general trend in this world, you will and I will be outside of that city. Many of our friends, many of our colleagues will be found outside that city. But I pray not you. But in order to be inside that city, we have to have that connection with God that gives us the power to, what does the text tell us? What? Anyone got a Bible open here? Can somebody help me? What does it say? Do His commandments. Do His commandments. Friends, that's not legalism, unless you're telling me that the Bible's legalistic. That's what the Bible tells us. Let's just bow our heads before we begin this session. Dear Lord, we thank You so much for the opportunity for us to meet together here at this tremendous Congress. Lord, I'm thankful for the chance to get to know new people, to present new ideas. Please send Your Holy Spirit to be in the hearts of each one of us. And Lord, I ask You to please send Your Holy Spirit to be on me. May what I do and what I say be acceptable in Your sight. Amen. I have to apologize to you for one thing. After this session, I am running. I am literally running to the parking lot. I am jumping in my car, and I am gone. Because today is my wedding anniversary. Young men, do not follow my example. Being away from home on your wedding anniversary is not the best move. I struggled over this invitation. I would have turned it down, but I wanted to touch and speak to young Adventists. I know you're not young, you're not kids. You're college age, most of you. And that's the age where you're deciding a lot of things in life. I know when I was in college, most of my friends lost their faith. Most of them did. Somehow, praise God, I didn't. It's not that I didn't struggle. It's not that I didn't know. Not that I always did the right thing. I'm not going to get up here and say, follow what I did. I'll tell you, don't follow what I did. But hopefully you'll end up more or less where I am. And that is, getting through these years, looking at your faith in a critical, careful light, opening up the Bible for yourself and getting connected to God in a way that's going to last you a lifetime. There are many, many things out there you're going to be dealing with. Those of you, how many of you are in secular universities? Secular universities. Okay, there's a struggle if you're in secular universities, and that is that you're going to be hearing a lot of things that are just flatly contrary to Christianity. Flatly contrary. Don't make any mistake about it. There is not that everyone is neutral about where we stand. Many, many, many people view what we stand for as being an anathema, as straight out in opposition to any kind of enlightenment or truth. They look at us as primitive because we have implicit faith in the Bible. They look at our faith as simplistic because we believe that God created this world. They look at it as unscientific, almost mystical, because of our belief in the inerrancy of Scripture. But friends, I can tell you, and you're going to be impressed by your professors. You're going to have great intellects out there. But I want to tell you, since my days living in this church, knowing people in this church, there are just as great intellects in this church who have faith that's solid as a rock. Amen. There are men and women at the height of their careers in medicine, in law, in engineering, in education, who do not let the sophistries of this world make their faith waver. For those of you in secular universities, stay strong. Just remember, you are not learning at the feet of God. You're learning at the feet of man. That's important. You're getting a good, solid education. I went to University of Virginia, and I went to Georgetown. Great schools. But I didn't learn about God at either school. I learned about God through this. And thank God the most important thing I ever learned comes right from here. How many of you are at Adventist colleges and universities? A good number of you. In some ways, I think being at an Adventist school can sometimes be a little bit harder than being at a secular school. I went to Newbold College for my undergraduate years, and so many of my friends now are no longer walking the path of truth. So many of them. It can be easy to be lazy in an Adventist school. It's easy to just see so many of your contemporaries compromising that you compromise as a matter of sort of convention. Don't expect every professor, even in an Adventist school, to have a connection that is alive and well with God. People who work for the church like me are just like you. We struggle. Sometimes we lose our way. Sometimes we lose our faith. Don't look to man to be connected to God. Look to Jesus Christ to be connected to God. And don't ever think that being a Seventh-day Adventist Christian is a path for those who are lazy, those who are intellectually sloppy, those who are conformers. It's not. If you want to be a true Seventh-day Adventist Christian, sharpen your intellect. Understand your faith at its deepest and best. And be ready to be strong, because this is not an easy path. Well, that was my introduction. I hadn't even thought about saying it, but it comes straight from my heart, because I know what it's like to be both in secular and Adventist colleges. I've seen so many of my friends compromise, friends, and I don't want any one of you to be outside of that kingdom. Let's ask ourselves a question. Today we're faced with many moral questions in society. This session is packed. Maybe all of you are just like really interested in same-sex marriage and abortion and who knows what else. You know, these are complicated issues. How should we analyze this and how should our church be involved? Well, the answer is we don't have a consensus on this, and I'm not going to pretend that we do. We're a church of 14 million people. We're a church of very diverse in every conceivable way. And what I'm going to present to you is one idea of how we should proceed. To do that, I'd like to begin with just a short period of history. Up until about 1920, I would argue that our church was a very activist church. It was a church that was out there in the public square, and we were hot on every single major issue in society that had a moral impact. It was during this stage that Adventists were at the forefront of the abolitionist movement. You know, people forget that. You know that Ellen White, talking about the fugitive slave laws, you know what the fugitive slave laws were? They were the laws that said if a slave came to your house, you had to turn that person in to the authority so they'd be returned back to slavery. Ellen White said that if we obeyed those fugitive slave laws, we were disobeying God. I want you to think about standing up tomorrow in church and saying, obeying the law of this land is disobeying God. Huh? It'd take a lot of guts to do that, wouldn't it? We were willing to do that in the early days of this church, and thank God for it. What courage, what fidelity, the ability to stand up on an issue like that. Sometimes we're so scared to stand up today. Friends, that issue ended up resulting in the death of 500,000 Americans in the Civil War. We haven't lost that many Americans in any other war. I think it's all the wars combined haven't killed as many Americans as the Civil War. Am I right on that? I believe so. Some of you are historians, right? Tell me, somebody's studying history out there. Don't just leave it to me. I'm a lawyer, for goodness sake. Who studied business undergraduate. Then we're also involved in the dress reform movement. What was the dress reform movement all about? It was about women's rights. It was about making sure that women had the opportunity to not just be little pretty porcelain pieces in someone's collection, but they could get out there and do something. That's what the dress reform movement was all about. And thank God we were led by a woman who got out there and did something. We were also at the forefront of the temperance movement. You know, sometimes today as a church, we're so timid. We'll talk about, well, what we individually do, right? Oh, I don't smoke, or I won't eat bacon chips on my baked potato, or something like that. You know, I don't smoke pot or something, which is all very important. But in the early days of Adventism, we didn't just say, we have some quibbles about this, we're going to be... We said, not only are we against alcohol, but we were against the destructive power of alcohol that is ripping families apart and is ripping society apart, friends. And if you want to know if it's still happening, you bet it is. You know, I've had so many people say to me, we were wrong on abolition. Or maybe you weren't born into a house where your father was an alcoholic. Maybe you weren't murdered by someone who was under the influence of alcohol. Had nobody... You know what? I'm trying to remember the percentage of crime in America that's performed while people are under the influence. And the vast majority of those are not under the influence of methamphetamines or heroin or cocaine or what have you. It's under alcohol. You know, you think about, you see the Budweiser horses, it's Christmas, it's lovely. Don't buy it. You are a sucker if you believe what you see in the mainstream media. Alcohol is ripping our families apart. It's ripping individuals apart, and it's ripping our society apart. And we pay an enormously high price for alcohol in this country. I went to an event on Capitol Hill not too long ago, and it was all the college presidents from across this country how to deal with binge drinking on college campuses. And you think, oh, you know, it's college. It's like Animal House. We're gonna have this great time. We're gonna have binge drinking. Every year, there are the creme de la creme of this country being terribly damaged, many, even some dying from binge drinking on college campuses. You know the number one reason why people are disbarred from practicing law? I had a friend actually who say, you know, I had friends who were in college, I saw them, they drank and they were fine and they smoked pot and it was no big deal. I bet you have friends like that. I bet you do. You know, when you're sort of 18 or 20, you can get away with a lot, but it all catches up with you. One of my friends said, actually my brother said to me, isn't it interesting, all the chickens come home to roost when you're about 30. Yeah, you know, for a little while you can get away with it. That's why sin is so enticing. You know, you can sort of like do this and do that, and you know, you sort of bounce around. But the habits that you start today are the things that destroy you tomorrow or make you tomorrow. Number one reason for disbarment, substance abuse. What's the number one reason that physicians are getting kicked off the rolls? People who've gone all the way through college, at the height of their intellectual power, they go to medical school, they do their residencies, some of them do their fellowships, they go all the way through. Why are they getting kicked out of the medical profession? Substance abuse. What percentage of car accidents, lives taken, involve alcohol? Let me tell you something, friends. I got no apology that this church was involved in the prohibition movement. And my only prayer is that one day our society will come back to its senses and realize the enormous price, not only that we pay, but that our children pay for the substance abuse that's rife in our society. The number one substance abuse being alcohol. Number one. We also were involved in the non-combatant movement. We spoke out for peace when peace was not popular. This is all at the beginning I'm talking about. And of course, we were at the forefront of our religious liberty movement. You know, the early days where we were small, we were nothing. We were like a little postage stamp on the face of America, yet we had people going up to Congress and testifying. We had a petition drive that got hundreds of thousands of signatures against Sunday laws and other issues. Friends, the early days of this Seventh-day Adventist church were not just about looking at ourselves. They weren't just about being a people set apart from society. It was about being a people set apart that was out there in society working to change society in a way that would make society better. Right? It was about saying we are not just sequestered from society. We have something that we can give to society. When Seventh-day Adventists speak up and give what we have, society is a better place as a result of it. You know, sometimes I have people tell me about, you know, issues today. They think these are issues that are outside of us. These are issues that are unrelated to us today. My response to that is, in this world, you are either pushing against what's happening, you're either out there trying to change the world or the world is changing you. Now, let me just give you one example of that. You know, when no-fault divorce was passed, we all thought that was something that was for them out there. Right? Oh, those people out there. They can get divorced and remarry, and, you know, what does it matter? They're all lost anyway. It's not us. Friends, today we have roughly the same divorce rate as the world. Why is that? Because the world isn't something out there. We're part of that world. And the world has an influence on who we are. Our society is part of who we are, and we're part of that society. When we're silent, our society is poorer. That was the initial phase of our church. I would argue that the second stage takes up to about now, where Adventists essentially stopped being quite as engaged in the public life. Big issues came, big issues went. The Adventist voice was very muted. Let me give you some examples. There was segregation in the civil rights movement. There were some Adventists who were at the front of that. But it was a small group. It wasn't our church in total. In fact, even some of our institutions were segregated. That's the truth. There's no use lying about it. That's the truth. How does that make you feel? Are you proud of that? Are you proud of it? I'm not proud of that. I wish that I could say that Martin Luther King Jr. was a Seventh-day Adventist minister and that the General Conference president was marching arm in arm with him. It wasn't the case. That's just the truth. But friends, just because it didn't happen in the past doesn't mean we've got to repeat the failures. When we look back at our past, you know, sometimes people say this, you know, I hear sort of pseudo-intellectuals saying, you know, the Adventist church, they weren't there for this, and they let down the show on this, and intimating that somehow this makes the church illegitimate. My response to that is absolutely not. Just like every institution that God has ever raised up, we have made mistakes. And I don't know if I would have been General Conference president, whether I would have been a better person or had more insight or been more active than the guy who was then. I don't know the person. I'm not going to, intimate anything to the contrary. What I am saying is, let's learn from the mistakes. Are you with me? It's the same thing in Nazi Germany. You know, people say, well, where were the Seventh-day Adventists during the Nazi regime? Well, it's complicated because obviously we're not that big in Germany to begin with. But Friedensau, which is a predominantly Adventist, was at that time predominantly Adventist, voted overwhelmingly for the Nazis. And in fact, there was a lot of positive things written about Hitler because, you know, Hitler didn't smoke and Hitler didn't drink. It's true. Now, he did do some other things that are a little bit troubling, like he committed genocide. But sometimes we get so wrapped up in the little things, like smoking and drinking. I'm not saying that those are little. They're very important. As I intimated, it's very close to my heart. But when somebody's out there doing mass killings and calling people, associating human beings with vermin and rats, attacking their businesses and marginalizing them and then exterminating them, that's a whole lot more important than whether you smoke or drink. I got to tell you. You know, somebody said, who would you rather have for your leader? And they compared Churchill, who used to drink every day and smoke cigars, versus Hitler, who was a vegetarian and so forth. And you said, of course, they don't tell you that right off. Who would you rather have? And then they reveal who you've chosen. But, of course, you need a little bit more details than what people eat and drink. And, you know, anyway. But many of our, and it's very easy to fall into this. It's not that Adventists gave up our positions on sort of righteousness and justice and what have you. But we kind of turned them into individual choices. We no longer were out there campaigning for control of alcohol. We said, we're gonna try to sort of say, well, we won't drink. Right? We weren't out there maybe campaigning about racial equity like our founders did with abolition, but maybe individuals, thought maybe we'd do this on sort of some kind of individual basis. And even during the Nazi regime, there were Seventh-day Adventist individuals who acted in just amazingly courageous manners. Make no mistake about it. We have tremendous heroes from the wartime period, including the president of the conference in Hungary, who systematically hid Jews and used the church mechanisms to do that. That takes guts, let me tell you. If you think you'd do that, you better go through those circumstances and know you're going to risk losing your life, your family's life, everything for somebody else. My boss, who's originally from France, his grandfather, who was not a Christian, he was actually a socialist, sort of a socialist / communist, a bit idealistic, went out there and helped Jews get across the border from France into Switzerland. Eventually, he was captured by the Nazis, and he died. He was killed. He was murdered. You know, we're so interested, we're so used to hearing these stories, and then he escaped. You know? Most people didn't escape. Many, many people, you know, you talk about 6 million, 8 million people, I don't know exactly how many were killed by the Nazis, but, you know, a very, very large number. Most of them don't escape. The escape stories are the ones, and then we say, and that was an answer to prayer, friends. Well, the Bible tells us of thousands and millions of people who have been faithful to God who are martyred. Where were their prayers? Well, I believe God heard their prayers, all right, heard their cries. But for one reason or another, he chose not to get them, not to free them, not to let them go. If you think that being a Christian is triviality, it's not. It's making the very, very hard decisions. Today, I think we stand as a church at a crossroads. We have those who are isolationists who look at our church as sort of what can we do inside our church? How can we get young people to be more interested in not smoking or drinking or other evil behavior, sexual immorality and what have you? Very important. But really don't have a vision for what we have to give to this society. And then there are others who want our church to be heard on the great issues of the day, the great issues of public morality that face our society. Among those are those who look back to our activist roots. I use the word activist, and I'm not ashamed to use it. Sometimes you see here on TV, oh, they're just an activist. Well, friend, I'd rather be an activist than sitting by passively and watching my society go down the drain. And if you don't think our society is going down the drain, wake up. Look around you. This isn't just about us. It's about our society as a whole. The number of people, number of children that are being born out of wedlock, the number of kids that are growing up without a dad in their home, the use of the number of children who are now being exposed to methamphetamine chemicals that they're in their house, the number of people suffering from sexually transmitted diseases. There was a study that came out that predicted that 50% of Americans between the ages of 15 and 25 would in the next 10 years would be infected with a sexually transmitted disease. That, if you can imagine, would be, now I don't want to be pejorative here, if this was an average group of young people in America, that would mean this half would have a sexually transmitted disease and this half wouldn't, or vice versa. People are acting like foolishly. I just saw something on TV, you know, I said I'm the worst person to stick in a hotel room by myself because I just sit there and flip through the channels. I don't have cable at home, and you know, whenever I sit in a hotel room flipping through the channels, I'm confirmed of why I shouldn't have it at home. But I had this thing about people suffering from HIV. The lives that are being ruined in America today by HIV. And just the incredible hardness of people's hearts who are out there who are being promiscuous and are not, who know that they're HIV positive. It's amazing. And people say, well, you know, now it's okay because you can take drugs. Friends, it is. If you think that being HIV positive is some kind of picnic, I wish you could have seen this documentary. It's shattering. It's shattering. Some of us want to get back to our activist roots. I plainly confess that I'm one of them. And I'm not ashamed of that. I think that our Adventist pioneers had it right. We have something, and we should be giving it to society. But that doesn't answer the question how we should act and on what issues we should act. Because we all understand that no matter how strongly we hold religious views, there's a limit to how much we can legislate those views, right? But where do we draw that line? How do we define that line? How should we define when it's okay for us to be out there passing laws to enforce our views of morality that are derived from our religion, and when that's inappropriate? I find that this is a very, very confounding issue to many Adventists. In fact, many Adventists, I don't think, have really thought this through very well. Because they'll say, oh yeah, you should be out there working for religious liberty, but we were wrong on prohibition. I've heard that before. I've never had somebody say that we were wrong on abolition, incidentally. Never had anyone say that. Well, some people say, well, because abolition was about somebody incarcerating somebody else, so against their will, but people who drink, that's their own will. Sure, but it's not a kid who grows up with an alcoholic parent. He doesn't choose that. What about his will? You understand what I'm saying? It's easy to say, well, this is a self-regarding behavior versus behavior that involves other people. Often you hear this today, as long as it's two consenting adults, it's okay. Right? Have you heard that? How many times? Or as long as you're okay with it, it's okay. Well, friends, we'll go through this a little bit more systematically, but there are dramatic problems with that idea, and we don't buy that as society in general, and for good reason. But let's take a quick look, a quick review before we get into that, on what the Old Testament tells us to do as far as being involved in the public square. The Old Testament is just full over and over again for God's people to be active in the public square to support justice, equity, human rights, morality, and many examples on that. For example, the book of Proverbs says, "Speak for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute. Defend the rights of the poor and needy." How much defending the rights of the poor and needy are you doing? How much is your church involved in defending the rights of the poor and needy? Are you? I'm not telling you to be a Republican or a Democrat. Different people have different views of how to do this. But we've just slashed thousands of people off the Medicaid rolls. And most of that happened without us individually or corporately raising a pip. Now, you can disagree on exactly what we should do for people who are poor. We can have that disagreement and the discussion. I'd be happy to have that with you. But surely, when we're talking about people who are too poor to have health insurance, cutting those people off from access to health care is not the answer, particularly since many of them are children. They don't decide which house to be born into. How can we, as the wealthiest nation on earth, deny them access? Hey, don't get me wrong. We're going to get into stuff that's going to tread on everybody's feet here. That's just one instance. I'm just throwing some things out to you. It just hits me. I mean, there it is. That's what the Bible tells us to do. There are many other instances. Of course, Esther's appeal to King Ahasuerus, is that how you pronounce it? Not a lot of people named after him these days. A lot more Johns and Pauls and so forth. Her action prevented genocide against the Jews. Today there's a genocide going on in Sudan. Are you willing to say something about it? If Esther is such a great example to us, she wasn't just preaching to the choir, friends. She was out there in the public square doing something. Joseph's work in the government of his day avoided mass starvation. It's not nothing. Moses confronted Pharaoh for his enslavement and led them to freedom. Well, we have just so many examples of this. I don't want to go... We could spend all day with all the exhortations of men and women of God who acted in the public square to advance their society. And maybe the best text on this is Isaiah 58, where we're told, just in past, "It is not this kind of fasting I have chosen. Rather, it is to loose the chains of injustice." Huh? "Untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke." You know, we can disagree, for example. And I'm throwing this... I should say, this is not... What I'm presenting today, I work for the Seventh-day Adventist Church, but I'm presenting you novel ideas. These are not things that have been passed by councils, or I don't have the imprimatur of committees and so forth. These are sort of new ideas. This comes from a paper I wrote for the Biblical Research Institute. Their response to it was, what would I say? Sort of semi-positive. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do with it. But I want to throw these ideas out to you because these are not settled issues. But I'm hoping that you're smart enough and you have the intellect and the curiosity enough to be interested in not only things that are settled and dry and everybody's got the answers to, but things that are complicated. And I'm giving you one idea of how to handle this. But let me throw this out to you. How are we going to loose the chains of injustice when we know that we live in a country... where innocent people have been put to death? You know, friends, people have different opinions on the death penalty. I know that out here we got different opinions. You know, when people do tremendously evil things, is it just to kill them? And the answer is, maybe it is, maybe it's not. But it certainly is not just to kill people who are innocent. Our justice system, anyone who knows anything about the justice system, I'm an attorney by training, I know a little bit about it, knows this is not a perfect system. We get it wrong. Holy cow, you send someone to death when you don't have a perfect system? It's a serious, serious thing. You know, one of the more dramatic illustrations of direct action to achieve justice was Abraham's rescue of Lot. And I love what Ellen White said, commenting on Abraham's mission. She said, "It was seen that righteousness was not cowardice. And Abraham's religion made him courageous in maintaining the right and defending the oppressed." Does your religion make you courageous in maintaining the right and defending the oppressed? Does it? Or are you spending all your time internally, maybe debating, you know, what kind of podium you should have in your church, or who should sit up the front, or maybe various different other things that, you know, we all have strong opinions on who should be doing this and what kind of music we should have and so forth. These are all fine things to spend some time on. I'm not degrading that. But my question is, what are you doing to maintain the right and defend the oppressed? Abraham regarded the claims of justice and humanity. His conduct illustrates the inspired maxim, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Friends, action in the public square is not just about imposing your will on somebody else. It's about loving your neighbor as yourself. What are you doing to love that kid whose father is coming home drunk every night? What are you doing to love our world that is infected increasingly by preventable diseases? Now, I have a cousin who died of AIDS. This isn't something that's just academic to me. I've seen what this stuff does. I've seen someone suffer and die, and I tell you, I loved him. keeping silent while people are telling you over and over again. And our mass society does this over and over again. Promiscuity is a way to find happiness. How many times have you heard that? It's in our music. It's in our movies. It's on our TV shows. Look, turn on any show you like on TV and see how often casual sexual relations are referred to. It's just the norm. Friends, you're either going to push it back against that or that's going to become who you are. That's how we live. That's who we are as human beings. You're either getting changed by that or you're out trying to change it. There's no equilibrium. There is no neutrality. That's my firm belief, my contention. New Testament also gives us many models. Christ's parable of the Good Samaritan is probably the best place to start. We're told to love our neighbors as ourselves, to intervene on their behalf. The message of the parable is at least in part very clear. When someone in society is hurt, Christians are there to help. But what if we could prevent that attack of the innocent in the first place? Rather than simply ameliorating the effect of it, wouldn't that similarly be an act of brotherly love? Clearly it must be. Just as preventative health care is the best health care, Doug Platter. Am I right? Okay, thank you. I got one amen today. Just as preventative health care is the best health care, preventing violence is far better than ameliorating the impact once that violence is inflicted. Right? In a world where much violence occurs at the hands of government, or is private action that's privileged by government inaction, the most effective way to defend against violence often, and the best way to love our neighbors is to act against, work peaceably to stop government violence and to ensure governments themselves stop private acts. Similarly, we should be out there talking and seriously discussing domestic violence. You think domestic violence is just out there in the world? Do you think that? It's not. The world, we are part of society, and society is part of us, friends, and we have domestic violence right here in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. We have to be honest about it. We have to address it. And friends, there is no place in Christianity for beating up those who God loves. Some have said that Christ himself never worked on public policy. You know, that's true. There's no record of him appealing to the Romans to stop human rights abuses, for example. It's asked, why should we act differently than he did? Or why did early Adventists act differently than he did? First, I think it's important to keep in perspective that Christ's public ministry only lasted 3.5 years. By necessity, his ministry was focused. During that time, for example, he never set up any hospitals. Does that mean we shouldn't have hospitals? Doug Platter? Yeah, there we go. Okay. Never set up any schools. Does that mean we shouldn't have schools? As Ellen White put it, dealing with the Romans was not, quote, an efficient way for Christ to achieve his goal of changing lives. Further, of course, the Roman Empire was not a democratic society. You understand that, right? It was a republic, but, you know, it wasn't really amenable to peaceful proddings. And we have to deal with that reality. You know, you can't write to Christians in North Korea and say, why don't you go out there and have a protest? You can do it. Or the home churches in China, go out there and make a big fuss. Find out what happens. I don't think that we should let ourselves be distracted, however, that implementing the teachings of Christ at times forces us and calls us to be engaged in society as a whole. Christ never established a hospital. He never worked for a shelter for battered women. He never built a school. He never negotiated to obtain price discounts on drugs to prevent the transmission of HIV/AIDS from affected mothers to their unborn children. He never did any of this, and yet the principles he established in his teachings and the working of the Holy Spirit on individual lives has been the basis for Christians to do all of this and much, much more. Thank God for that. We don't just have a religion that's some sort of a esoteric thing out there where we sort of believe something, but we do nothing. We have to have a religion that's practical, that is relevant. I should just check my time. Last time I kind of got carried away, didn't I? That Sunday law stuff. I don't really have a long time to get to the nub of this. We've already talked a little bit about many of the very, very important activism on the part of early Adventists. One of my favorite statements that Ellen White made is this. She says, "Men of intemperance have been in office today in a flattering manner, expressing their approbation of the course of the Sabbath keepers not voting, and express the hope that they will stick to their course and, like the Quakers, not cast their vote. Satan and his evil angels are busy at this time, and his workers upon the earth. May Satan be disappointed, is my prayer." Elsewhere, she goes so far as to say we should vote on Sabbath to support temperance movement. But this is maybe this comes to the nub of what our approach, I think, should be. This is another quote from Ellen White. She says, "Many deplore the wrongs which they know exist, but consider them free from any responsibility in the matter. This cannot be. Every individual exerts an influence on society." Are you with me? Who exerts an influence on society? In the back, please. Are you guys still listening back there? This is the worst room in the world to speak to because, you know, you're way back there. You probably have totally zoned out. You're thinking about anything but what I'm talking about. Who exerts an influence on society? Lady in the red sweater right in front of me. Are you with me? Do you know? How about that guy sitting next to you? Honestly. Oh, please. This is a sign to you. Every individual exerts an influence on society. In our favored land, in whose land?
Our land.
Okay. I'm looking to this woman in the back there. I can see she's zoned out, honestly. I come all the way from D.C. and that's the best I can get. This cannot be. Every individual has an influence in our society. In our favored land, every voter has a voice in determining what laws shall control this nation. Should not that influence and that vote be cast on the side of temperance and virtue? The advocates of temperance and virtue fail to do their whole duty unless they exert their influence by precept and example, by voice and pen and vote, in favor of prohibition and total abstinence. We need not expect that God will work a miracle to bring about this reform and thus remove the necessity for our exertion. Friends, this is the principle that she enunciated regarding prohibition. But couldn't it equally be applied to every other issue that has this moral component like this? We could go over so many other quotes that she has about this, but if you are reading her words, you know very well what I'm talking about. But I think that's one of my favorite. Every individual exerts an influence in society. The question is, are you going to influence are you going to exert that influence? And if so, in what way? Friend in the back. Next to the girl in the red sweater. Apparently, maybe love interest of the girl in the red sweater. I don't know. Are you going to exert your influence? And if so, are you going to do it for virtue? Or are you going to do it for bad? Neutrality, friends, is not an option. You exert an influence in society whether you like it or not. Just by being here, you're exerting an influence. Some Adventists argue that religiously motivated morality should not be the basis of public policy in a secular state. But we shall see from history and from reason that this position is not sustainable. This does not mean, however, that Adventists should fail to establish limits on public advocacy. Of course, we must. The church must establish such limits. And I would suggest that there are solid principles upon which to establish these limits. William Wilberforce Do any of you know who William Wilberforce is? William Wilberforce is one of the most important Christians of the 1700s. Why? He was not only a Christian, he was a member of the British Parliament. He was an evangelical Christian, and he dedicated his life to one, his public life, to one issue: eradicating slavery from Great Britain and the British Empire. Those of you who don't know about William Wilberforce should look up, get a book about him on Amazon.com or one of these things, BarnesandNoble.com. This is a guy that every Christian should know about. He was not a Seventh-day Adventist, okay? But he was a dedicated Christian, and I have every faith that God is going to reward his fidelity. He suggested, year in and year out, put laws forth. It took him 18 attempts until he finally passed a law that eradicated slavery from Great Britain. 18 attempts, friends. And before he died, slavery was eradicated not only in Great Britain, but in the entire British Empire. But let me ask you a question. Did he do right or did he do wrong? See, William Wilberforce was a Christian, and the reason why he pressed for abolition, and it is unambiguous, was because he believed from his Christian morality that this was wrong. Was he imposing his religious views on society? Well, in a way, I guess he was, wasn't he? He was involving his Christian morality on society. Isn't this wrong? What about Martin Luther King? You know what he did for a living? He was a minister. Did he do wrong? We could ask that of almost any of the great reformers. Even Mahatma Gandhi referred back to religious principles for his work in India. The lady who, Susan B. Anthony, who got eventually was important in getting the women's right to vote. There's no doubt that her influence on her ideas of gender equality comes from her Quaker upbringing, because Quakers had a very strong tradition of gender equality. Was she wrong? Well, I can see some of you are getting all wobbly on that. For goodness sake, don't get wobbly on the women's right to vote. Oh, no. We're going to have we might have a woman president pretty soon. You guys better wake up. I mean, I think that we're a little bit beyond the question on this, and you can say amen. I don't think that God takes any pleasure in women being marginalized in society. We can have our disagreements on women's ordination without getting wrapped up in that stuff. I'm very proud to be I'm now Mr. Standish, and my wife is Dr. Standish, you know, and somebody said, how do you like being sort of Mr. Standish and Dr. Standish? And I say, I'm very proud. Very proud that my wife is a PhD. She's got a few more years of education than I do. I just wish she'd make more money than I do. That's all I'm asking. She made the mistake of getting her PhD in education and teaching it at Adventist College. Hence that comment. No, she's very dedicated and she does a wonderful work. I'm joking. So anyway, were any of these people wrong? The answer to these questions must be no. Of course William Wilberforce did the right thing. Of course Martin Luther King did the right thing. Yeah, Abraham Lincoln with his appeals to God. You know, you just can't say that all these things that they did were wrong because they had a religious basis. You can't, can you? Nobody could say that. Even the hardest ACLU secularist couldn't say that. You know, without some kind of moral compass, you end up in these utilitarian nightmares like fascism and communism. You want to talk about a nightmare? How many people were killed by the communists? You know, we don't talk about it anymore. Everyone talks about Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler did a terrible thing. He's despicable. The Nazis were absolutely, just unbelievably evil. But what about the communists? Chairman Mao, it's estimated, killed 70 million of his own people. You know, people aren't sort of, if you see someone with like a red flag these days, it's okay, Che Guevara, whatever, you know. Maybe, you know, if you see someone with a Nazi symbol, you say, well, this is just totally out of the realm of sort of, you know, decency, and it should be. But why do we still put up with people with hammers and sickles? Friends, that system killed more people than just about anything ever in the history of mankind. I don't think there's any other philosophical system. We need a society that has some kind of moral compass. And in addition, everybody is guided by some kind of moral compass, friends. There's nobody out there who doesn't make decisions morally. I hope so. Even people we totally disagree with, they have their moral structure. And for the vast majority of us, that moral structure is built around our religious values. You can't get away from it. You know, one of the more interesting experiments of trying to get away from religion is Immanuel Kant. How many of you know who Immanuel Kant is? Many of you, he's a philosopher, very, very important. He came up with this thing called the categorical imperative that most of you don't understand who he is. Maybe I won't get into this as much. But bottom line is, he tried to come up with a secular idea of morality. He went through a lot of reasoning. He's still very well respected among philosophers and so forth. He's one of the preeminent thought leaders in history. But what's very interesting is that at the end of all his moral reasoning, he came up with a moral construct or a moral law that looks very much like do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's just expressed in different language. And he said, but I got here by reason, not by religion, so that makes it kosher. That makes it okay. That makes it applicable. And sometimes people use that. Oh, well, you know, you don't have to rely on religious morality. Look at this. We have Immanuel Kant. But Immanuel Kant is just regurgitating Jesus Christ. He's just doing it in a different way. You think that Immanuel Kant would have come to that conclusion if he hadn't grown up in a Christian society? I don't believe that. I wish we could go through that in greater detail because it's important, particularly for those of you who are in secular universities, but time is limited. If we need government that's based on morality, and if secular morality, even any secular morality that has any kind of creates any kind of humane outcomes is actually based loosely on Christianity, which I would posit it is. You know, even in countries where you think of secular Europe, they have a very strong feeling about do unto others. You know, they've got those. Where did that come from? It comes from their Christian heritage. That's where it comes from. They're living on the fumes of Christianity. If that's the case, we can't avoid basing our laws on morality, and for those of us with religious faith, that's where we draw our morality from, and for those of us even without religious faith, subconsciously many of us draw still our morality from that faith of our fathers and mothers. Thus, even if it were possible, secular alternatives, even if it was possible in the minds of the populace and public officials to craft and interpret the laws of the land, that secular alternatives to religious morality would more than likely rest on religious morality so explicitly rejected. Hopefully that makes sense to you. It's kind of regurgitating what I've just said. Anyway, so you can't get away from having religion and morality impact the way that we have our laws. So that begs another question, and that is, where should we draw the line? And I'd say that there's three different options. The first option is that we should avoid legislating morality altogether. This is encapsulated in the oft-repeated phrase, you can't legislate morality. How many of you have heard that phrase? You can't legislate morality. Is that true? Well, friends, is murder immoral? Do we have a law against it? Is that legislating morality? Of course it's legislating morality. Of course you can. What's your alternative? Legislating amorality? Immorality? You can legislate that too. Of course you legislate morality. What people who use this, all laws are based on a view of morality, from our tax code through to laws that ban such immoral actions as murder, theft, slander, and so forth. if we can't legislate morality, it is not that we can't legislate morality, it's that we cannot help but legislate morality whether we want to or not. It's virtually all our laws have some kind of moral foundation and some kind of moral impact. In fairness, when people say this, what they typically mean is you can't legislate sexual morality. Since the sexual revolution, we've sort of taken sexuality into our own sort of special area. We said, you can't touch that. But we still have laws that even legislate on that area, don't we? Well, you have all kinds of laws that do that. We have laws pertaining to public nudity. If you don't believe me, well, I won't advise you to. We have laws that involve marriage, divorce, rape, incest, prostitution, polygamy. What are those laws? Are they not based on sexual morality? Isn't that what they're about? Of course they are. The state can, does, and I would say must legislate on matters of morality, including sexual morality. So I reject the idea that we should avoid legislating on morality because it's inevitable that we do anyway, and it's really, whenever you hear that, you know someone's just not thinking. It's like, you know how you get these bumper sticker things? And you know, if a thought can sort of reside on a bumper sticker, not always, but 9 times out of 10, you know, it's probably not the most profound thought you could ever come up with. Some people say we should avoid legislating, on private matters. Because we've established that you can't help but legislate on morality. Most of us, that morality is drawn from our religious views. Even those who deny religious views still base their morality in part on religion. We've said that you can't avoid just legislating on moral issues in general. So another second option is that we legislate only, that we avoid legislating on private matters. That is, some element of private lives is separate and cannot be touched. That is, we should avoid laws pertaining to the most intimate of human activities. In other words, there's a private zone over which government should not legislate. There are two main problems with drawing the line on privacy. The first is that many intolerable acts based on religious morality were perpetrated not because of the victim's public acts, but rather the victim's private acts. Thus, the privacy rationale is under-inclusive. In other words, many of the persecution of individuals, was persecution based on the way that they acted in public. If we were to say it's inappropriate to only punish people for their private action, it's inappropriate to punish people only for their private action, what would we do about people's public actions that still should be equally protected? For example, praying in public in times past in some countries would be punishable, even though it's not a private action. At the same time, it proves to be equally under-inclusive, equally over-inclusive. Private actions, even the most intimate of actions, often have the most significant of public impacts. Society may not have an interest if one person is an opium addict, for example, but it certainly has an interest if 75% of the workforce spends its days in opiate-induced stupor. Are you with me? Private actions, in cumulative, have enormous public impact. If you don't believe me, look at the history of China during the Opium Wars. How many of you have studied Chinese history? A couple, 3, 4 of you. You should get onto that because, you know, China's not entirely an insignificant country, you know. Most Americans are just bone ignorant about what's going on over there and what their history is, and I think I'd recommend, well, most of us are ignorant about our own history, let alone history overseas, but anyway. Not you, though. You've got the opportunity to become. Similarly, society may not have an interest in one couple's divorce, but when half the marriages end in divorce, with the resulting societal dislocation of a large mass of children, society surely must have an interest. Thus, just regulating, saying we can't regulate anything in the private zone, doesn't work. Are you with me? Because private actions in the cumulative have tremendous public. What if the whole town is addicted to methamphetamines? You know, it makes a difference. You better do something, even though it might be just each individual making a decision to ingest or smoke or whatever, shoot this stuff. It has a tremendous impact. The final alternative, as we face how we're going to draw the lines in this issue, is that we can avoid legislating on matters between God and man. And this is where I suggest we should draw the line. I believe it is simpler. I think it's a better way to go, and I think it's more organically sound. Simply put, it is that public officials should never attempt to legislate over matters that relate to human relationship to God. There are three primary reasons why we should draw the line there. First and foremost, from a Christian perspective, Christ never used the arm of the state to enforce religious observance. Secondly, there's a level of humility that each of us must have when dealing with the mind of God. God is in a unique position to regulate matters pertaining to his relationship to man. No individual or government is privy to a full understanding of his will. And for us to presume to punish crimes against him is an act of hubris. Finally, the overwhelming bulk of atrocities that have been committed in the name of religious morality involve government punishing individuals for offenses against God. This includes drowning witches, burning heretics, stoning blasphemers, persecuting Sabbath violators, and so forth. These are not crimes against each other, and they are not actions that hurt society in any tangible way. Rather, they are crimes against God, and God is in the best position to punish those crimes. So let me just pull this back to what we're talking about here, because I want to be clear. I know that these are complicated ideas, and in some ways I'm trying to fit a semester's worth of study into a quick seminar. It saves you a lot of time. You're not paying a cent for it, at least as far as I know. At least I'm not getting paid to give it. So, but it's important. And that is, I would suggest that Christians acting out of their moral impulse in the way they legislate is fine unless they try to legislate in matters that relate to man's relationship to God. You can pass laws on relating to morality. You can pass laws that even involve private issues, when viewed on the cumulative, have a destructive societal impact. There's one other area that I think that Adventists should avoid being involved in, and that is areas that involve issues where we have no special insight. Particularly, there's been a lot of Christians who've gotten involved in advocating various different economic theories. And what my perspective is when I listen to pastors wax eloquent about economics, they're often seem to be very wrong. They don't seem to, sometimes they get it right, but we don't have any special sort of insights necessarily on precisely how to structure a society to maximize economic output, for example. And I think that we need to be humble about that. So as we look prospectively on what issues we should be involved in as individuals and as a church, my contention is that first we should be ready to stand up and be involved. We've got no choice. Silence is not neutrality. Silence is compliance. The second thing is we should be involved in public issues where we have a competency, where we have something to bring to the table, where Adventists have some insight, except that we should not be trying to enforce anything that relates to God's man's relationship to God. We'll leave that to God to do. Are you with me? So where does this leave us with the hot-button issues of today? Where does it leave us, for example, on abortion, same-sex marriage, war, societal benefits for the poor? My personal belief is that there is a place for Seventh-day Adventist Christians in speaking up on these issues. Not along party basis, not on the basis of our political inclinations, but evaluating each issue in light of the revelation that we've been given. Divorce, similarly, these kinds of issues that have touching on our society, drug laws, alcohol laws, the whole nine yards. These are not issues that relate simply to man's relationship with God, but they relate to man's relationship to each other and what kind of society we have, what kind of world we're going to live in. I know many of you think of these issues as being out there somewhere. That's the world, this is us. But like I said with the no-fault divorce thing, make no mistake about it. What's out there impacts us. Many of you probably have come from families where there's divorce. My parents are divorced, so I know what it's like. How many, I won't ask you to put up your hands. Let me just talk just very briefly. People have asked me a lot this over the last few days, what's that church's position on abortion? The answer is that we have a position that abortion is, for birth control purposes, is wrong. But to date, we've chosen not to take a position in the public square. In other words, we haven't taken a position on the legalization or outlawing of abortion. That's the church as a whole. Individuals have taken very different perspectives. I personally believe that there is a role for us to be involved in that particular issue in the public square, and I've said so to anyone who'll listen, and I'll say so to you. I have a child who was born 10 weeks premature. I've been in the NICU for 2 months while she was getting strength. I've seen little children suffer, some of them die. When I think of the fact that over 40 million children in the United States have been aborted since 1973, it breaks my heart. Now, I'm all for choice, friends, and I'm all for freedom. But I'm not for the freedom to kill another human life. And I know it's a complicated issue. I know it's a personal issue. I'm not here to judge anyone, but that's my personal belief. Why is abortion wrong? If we can agree that it's wrong for birth control, why is it wrong? You ever ask yourself that? Why? The only reason I can figure out, we're not against birth control. The only reason I can figure out why abortion is wrong is because it's the taking of a human life. You may have a different perspective on that, and I appreciate that. I know it's a complicated moral issue. Similarly with same-sex marriage, we don't have a consensus on it as a church. The church in Canada has spoken very strongly against same-sex marriage. Our church in America, some conferences have been very strong, for example, the Pacific Union. Other places have been kind of muted. Some have just been totally silent. What I would advise you as individuals, including you in the back, the red sweater, the young man sitting next to her, the guy with the white sweater with the black stripes, all of you guys back there, my advice to you is to think through these things carefully. Evaluate them. Don't fall down for bumper sticker nonsense, but think, how does our morality touch the world? And how should our influence, which we have and we cannot avoid, how does that touch the world around us?
For additional CDs of this message or for other presentations by these speakers and others associated with ACM, you may contact us as follows. In the United States and Canada, dial our toll-free order line, 800-233-4450. International calls, dial 717-652-7000. Tax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Our internet email address is info@americancassette.org. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our Entar catalog is online, and we accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover credit cards. Maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages since 1975, American Cassette Ministries, a 501c3 nonprofit ministry, is dependent upon your generous tax-deductible contributions in order to maintain our low prices and to continue providing you the finest genuine Adventist preaching until Jesus comes. He's coming soon.